Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Welcome to the Currency podcast. My name is Paul Flynn, former Dublin footballer and GAA columnist with The Currency. Today, I'm delighted to speak with Gary Keegan, CEO of Uppercut, a high-performance advisory organisation that works with leaders across sport and business. I had the pleasure of working with Gary for over 5 years through his time as the high-performance coach with the Dublin senior football team. And he left a really great impact on me, mainly because of three things. The first is his ability to take complex terms and make them simple and practical. His second is the consistency in his messaging. And the third is his energy and his passion, which I hope that you get a piece of today. We spent an hour speaking about high performance, Dublin GAA, Jim Gavin, his career, and to be honest with you, it could have lasted a lot longer. Gary Keegan, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast. Gary, we'll start off by saying you've been the best high performance coach that I've ever worked with over the course of my 13 years, and I've worked with quite a few. Your repertoire, your CV speaks for itself. We've worked with as a director of the Institute of Sport right since 2006, the high performance director of IABA, leading to such a successful program that we have for Irish boxing in Ireland. You're lecturing in London Business School across business strategy, leadership and performance. You're the sports psychologist currently with the Irish rugby team. You've worked with the Dublin GAA football, ladies football, cricket. The list goes on, Gary. Tell me how, as a high performance guru, these all sound like really exciting projects to be involved in, but where does it all start? How do you get onto a journey like that? And talk us through that experience.
It feels at the beginning certainly a little bit accidental. I'd certainly remove the guru from that opening piece, because there's every day is a learning day. Never feel kind of comfortable in that space. But my journey, I guess, began with my passion, which was boxing, and wasn't very good as a boxer, a bit better as a coach. And I worked my way through the system from being a club coach to looking after, I guess, squad training for Dublin. I then tried a little bit of administration. I became the vice president of Dublin County Board. After a year, I knew that wasn't for me. Kind of started to really focus in on my coaching then, worked my way up through the ranks. And a lot of people know the story in 2002, 2001, after the Sydney Olympic Games, the Irish government decided to invest in Olympic sport, Olympic and Paralympic sport, because we simply weren't performing on the international stage. The rest of the world had moved on. We're investing in world-class and high-performance programs, supporting athletes with all the things that we're very aware of now in this country: sports science, sports medicine, full-time coaches, directors of performance, that type of stuff. We were way behind, probably two decades behind. But we started with an investment in four programs. I think it was sailing, athletics, boxing and rowing with four first programs. So I was sitting on a national coaching committee for my sport at that time, and I put my hand up to volunteer to put the first business case for high performance together for our sport. After that business case was developed, we won investment to build a program. So I put the first plan together and put my hand up for the role as performance director of that program. And the rest is pretty much history. We go on to do some good work in that space and have a level of success at European, World and Olympic Games. And after 2008, I got an opportunity to just put my hand up for a role in the Irish Institute of Sport and end up leading that organisation in from 2008 through to 2017.
And a little bit of success is probably an understatement. So as director of IABA, 29 medals, am I right in saying, across?
Yeah, 29 medals, European, World and Olympic. It's gone on to achieve 80 plus medals now at all grades, 15 to 17, 17 to 19, senior men, senior women. So it's a pretty incredible story that continues to achieve at the highest level.
Something I'm sure you're proud of, to be, you know, at the forefront of that, and you know, the genesis of that, if you like. And then moving on to the role with the Irish Institute of Sport, spanning all sports, and what was the overall kind of responsibility there?
Well, it's almost like we to put a essentially a world-class infrastructure and service support to our most talented athletes in the country, both at Olympic and Paralympic level. And we had up to 20-plus sports that were drawing down on high-performance investment from, at that time, the Irish Sports Council, now Sport Ireland. And the Institute's job was to provide sports science, sports medicine, life skills support, education and career support to our athletes, but also to support coaches to perform at the highest level. So we had an elite coach development program for our transition coaches who were working with our development athletes and our podium coaches, as we described them then, the guys that were working with the senior programs. We also built a program then for performance directors who had a responsibility to lead, develop these programs for us, so that we could assure that they were getting the support to be the best that they could be. So that was essentially the role of the Institute over that time. We then based ourselves out at campus. We built a multi-sport high-performance centre where our athletes could come and draw down on their services, science, medicine, but also could train. We had a pretty impressive strength conditioning facility out there, and we had a 130-metre straight track as well for athletes. And The boxers then moved from South Circular Road, National Boxing Stadium, out to campus as well. So you had all these athletes and coaches coming into the same environment, mixing, and that kind of social engagement that we got across sports, experience and lessons was hoping the objective was to try and raise all boats with the same tide. And I think we're seeing some of the fruits of that labour in the performances that we're seeing both at European World and an Olympic and Paralympic level over the last two cycles.
And I've been out there many times, and it's an astonishing facility, and it's going to continue to grow, and the investment obviously is required there. But you just get a buzz as a high performer being out there. It's where you want to be. You're surrounded by people who are, you know, just trying to achieve their goals through sport. But I was really impressed by the kind of holistic development that was, you know, afforded to people and to athletes, that it wasn't just about them as a performing in their chosen field, but it was also there to support them with their development as people, as professionals as well. And something probably I've kind of good experience with the GPA, and I just felt that was one of the things that really struck me out there, which was excellent. So how does moving from like working across different sports there, how do you transition then into working with specific teams as the high performance coach within a group? And I know, like, from, like, if we answer that one maybe broadly first, and then we can kind of dive into, you know, how you got involved with Dublin, if you like.
Well, when I left, one of the reasons why I left boxing, and we had worked extremely hard at a very tough 6-year journey into that kind of Olympic success, and the natural tendency would be, let's hang on here and kind of enjoy the next. You know, we had quite a bit of momentum at that point. We'd made good progress, but I felt I wanted to explore whether that skill set was transferable into other high performance environments. I was just curious about what that would mean, and for my own development, I wanted to really challenge myself outside of boxing that I knew very well, very passionate about, and could I bring that thinking right to impact on others within that space? That desire to work among the best, or to help those that were striving to be the best to realize that potential, that was something that was a big passion for me and a big driver. So it's kind of really out of my comfort zone, like, asked to do initially a technical role. I was the technical director of the Institute of Sport to begin with. My role was to develop coaches to essentially build or cultivate high performance programs and systems. So that's the reason I stepped out there. It wasn't my intention after the Institute to start to work with teams or other sports, because I was essentially, you know, I was more indirect in the impact I was having. I was kind of, we were building performance planning processes so that people could understand what it takes to develop a high performance team or program at that level. And when we speak about program, we mean every grade level, the talent pathway, and then the senior program in there, so that each of those programs have a legacy investment, so that the new athletes coming through, the most talented, are getting that opportunity to develop appropriately in the right environment. So I never seen myself stepping into a space where I was working with directly with teams after I left the Institute, kind of more by accident, or people knowing that I'd done some good work and maybe hearing about it and wanting to come and have a chat and talk about it. So yeah.
And that makes sense, because even we'll get on to now how you got involved with Dublin, and I'll just give a little story, because one of the pieces that I wrote for the Currency this year was around a kind of a recap on 2015, when we were beating Mayo in the semi-final of an All-Ireland. We were 6 points up and they came back and drew the game and should have won the game actually, and we just held on, but we won the replay and we beat them in the replay. And I remember that very clearly, because I was probably subject to deep analysis of a play that I had whereby I took a shot which I never should have taken, and we were 6 points up and I should have been much more in control of my emotions, much more playing in the present and not getting ahead of myself. And that brings me right back to that point in time, because that was when you came into the Dublin setup, or it's certainly when us as players felt your introduction, which was quite strange to come into a setup at a semi-final point, but that's what happened in that space in that time. But I suppose to go back to what you did previously really makes sense. That's the type of person that Jim would bring into the setup. It's not just but a sports psychologist who's going to come in and maybe have a shelf life of maybe 18 months or 6 months when they come in with a big bang and then they're gone. But yours was built on foundations and processes, and you know, you were layering on to what we're doing, which makes sense because that's the type of approach Jim would have taken. But I suppose the question is, like, talk to me through, how did you get involved? Where did you maybe meet Jim, or you know, how did that all kind of come about, that you come into our setup at a semi-final point of a season, which you know is quite unheard of?
Well, I think it's. Like Jim, let's just mention Jim Gavin, right? Because he's a very curious individual. He's always looking for something that will elevate the team or the group or the environment in there. He's always searching. He's always researching. And you guys would have had Bernard Dunn in the program on the team around you guys at that time. And obviously, I know Bernard because of boxing. I know him since he was 11 or 12 years of age, and Jim must have reached out to Bernard and said, look, can you try and make contact with this guy, Gary Keegan? I'd like to have a chat with him. So he came over to the Institute of Sport, and it was while he was reflecting on the 2014 performance, the defeat against Donegal, what that meant for the team. And so I sat down with him. It was the first time I'd met him, first time I was aware of him, even. Nice. We locked ourselves in a room. We ended up in there for 3 hours, right, talking high performance, teams, failure, success, all the stuff that we love to talk about. And I was really impressed with this guy and how much rigor he was putting into his essentially reflection of that performance that year, the weeks, the days that led into it, the actual performance itself. And he was my memory of at the time, he was really focused on ensuring that the lessons would provide a platform for that team's performance and growth into the future. That he wasn't going to leave that season behind without taking something from it that was very significant around where we would take this team next. And I think there were a number of things that they took from that game and that season, and maybe their headspace leading into that game, that certainly served the team and the group going forward. But Jim, as the leader of that group, felt a very deep responsibility to ensure that that was leveraged in the fullest way possible.
Yeah, and like, you need, I think in sport and, you know, any walk of life really, you need to experience that type of chaos or upset or, you know, adversity to really be able to grow, you know. And that was one thing that Jim was phenomenal. Like, one of our values as the group was commitment to growth, right? And but people can have that as a value and not believe in it, but certainly Jim believed in it and we all did. We all bought in as a result. But to be able to have a commitment to growth, I think you have to show vulnerability. And as a group, as individuals, you have to be able to really be vulnerable. Let yourself get to that stage so that you can then realise, okay, where are the areas where I can grow, both individually and collectively. And Jim was very good at that. And like, how powerful can that be when you have that from a leadership point of view, but also as a collective, you know, group?
It's funny, you know, because during that 3-hour discussion, we discussed vulnerability, where I asked Jim, does he facilitate that? Does the environment facilitate the players to be truly vulnerable? Because only with vulnerability can we get to the real organs of performance and failure and success. We can only get really under that. And if people feel safe to be vulnerable in the environment, it's not saying I'm passing the problem that I have or the challenge I have onto anyone else and I'm asking them to solve it. It is, I just want to share it and recognize that it's okay for me to have this obstacle right now, or this difficulty with my mental strength, or this difficulty with my technical performance, whatever it is. But that willingness to, or that openness within the environment to share vulnerability within the group, became a very powerful aspect of the culture in that team going forward. So I think that first opportunity to really look back at that season, to look back at the lead into that game, to that game performance itself, and people to be really open about what they were experiencing and to be able to challenge others about their contribution, etc., turned out to be extremely powerful, and something that was culturalized and systemized within how we reviewed games, how we reviewed seasons thereafter. And it became a very, very powerful tool, I think, for the team.
And it certainly is. But it takes consistency. It takes, you know, I've listened to you before mentioning a phrase which you've called me out on it, where you say, we built a very powerful culture. We built a great culture. And you don't like that phrase. Tell me why you don't like that phrase, because it answers kind of the question that I was going to have.
Because culture is a living form. It sits within the human dynamic, the human group dynamic. It never stops continuing to grow. And it's either going to go somewhere that you don't want it to go, or it's going to somewhere where you're directing it to go. So it needs to be cultivated. So this, my initial thinking was, we build high performance teams, we build systems, but we cultivate is a much better term, because we're never finished. And that's part of the issue and part of the challenge that many teams or organizations face. They think they go into an exercise to set out some values and standards for the team, and then we never actually discuss them again. We never go after them again. We don't really hold people to account around what's important, and we don't see ourselves evolving. Surely we evolve as our context shifts. We need to evolve as organizations, as individuals, and as teams. So it's the cultivation of culture that's really, really important. And it the leader is the central lens for that, in my view. If the leader is not on top of that and not continuing to encourage and stimulate that, well, then the members of the team or the players within the team don't take ownership. And I think players or members of a team pay attention to what the leader pays attention to, because often we take our cues from leaders. So if the leader deems it to be important, well, then the team deem it to be important also. So one of the things that Jim had said to me in those early years was repetition, repetition, repetition. And it wasn't a word that inspired me. And I really got underneath the bonnet with him around, what do you mean by this repetition? He said, well, if I don't reinforce it, right, the players won't continue to value it. So what do we, that's the cultivation exercise. That's turning the soil, that's planting new seeds, that's watering it, that's going back to see the quality of the growth. What are these values delivering to us right now? Why would our values need to evolve? Why would we have to bring new values into the team as the team evolves, etc.? So that's how I see
versus the idea of building it, where that's finite, there's an end point. You build a house, it's built,
it's done. Yeah.
Where this is all, you have to manage it, you have to continuously reflect on it. And that's where vulnerability becomes important, because you have to be able to, even if you win or if you lose, be able to deeply analyse your performance to identify opportunities for growth. And that's, people talk about growth mindsets, that's effectively what that is. And that was from the culture, because we were excellent at analysing the process of analysis, let's say. it happened regardless of whether we won or whether we lost, or whether things went well or whether things didn't go well. And that was built a part of our culture. That was just who we were. It was, and I think that not only is Jim and his leadership style, but it's the influence that you're bringing in too. It's not just you as a performance psychologist standing in front of a group, getting people G'd up for a game, or it's the foundations that you lay. Like, repetition was so important, because when the vision was articulated, we all knew it. When what we were trying to achieve to become the greatest performing Gaelic football team was clear. That was our vision, right? And everybody understood then what their role was leading up into that. And that's, you know, all that's the important part of having a high performance unit, but you have a culture that's being cultivated and managed. And the role of Jim versus you in that is an interesting dynamic. How did that kind of work? Was it you advising Jim, or, you know, was it primarily Jim who led this? And
so let me just go back. There's a couple of points that I want to kind of discuss on what you've just raised there. One thing is, if all you respect is success, you're going to probably visit failure more often. So you've got to respect failure in the same way you do success. Because I always had the view that there's success and failure, and there's failure and success. So if we elevate them, and a lot of people spend a lot of time on the failure, on the mistake, on the error, and not enough time on the success, right? Actually, you know, what has delivered us this success? Why do we need to sustain it? What needs to be maintained? What needs to be improved? Well, what can we learn from the failure? How far off were we from having success in that regard? So getting in under the bonnet around failure and success, and treating them with the same level of respect is really important. And I think that in high performance environments that sustain over a longer term and are more consistent over a longer term, there's definitely a higher level of respect for both aspects of that, and not just a higher weighting on the failure end of it. So that piece is important. The other piece I wanted to kind of pick up is that I'm not a psychologist. So that's really interesting, isn't it? Because all my learning has been by doing, right? By facing problems, by getting around obstacles, by fixing things. And as a coach, like, I've spent my time in this world of researching high performance, understanding it, observing human beings failing and succeeding, advising and coaching in that space. And it's brought me to a space where I've impacted on others, which has created other people looking to come in or to draw me into their discussions and to their journeys. So I accidentally find myself in Dublin. I didn't feel I was the right guy for the job, because most of my time had been spent in individual sport, right? Mm. So I was moving into a team dynamic, and that was certainly out of my comfort zone. So that's important just to be clear on that. Yeah. I never set myself up as a psychologist, but I do believe that I've earned the right to call myself an expert in performance because I've spent so much time in it. My relationship with whoever I work with, the leader of the group, is really important. First of all, I have to be in that circle of trust. I have to have the full context so I understand that. And Jim was willing to allow me into that circle of trust and to give me the full context so I knew what I was dealing with. Mm. The design of my work was very much a co-creation, because if Jim is clear on where he wants to go next, I have a better chance of being accurate around the approach that I take with the group. So I'd say he's downloading what I have, because that's the type of person he is. He'll go and he'll download anything he can from an individual or from a piece of research that he believes will help the group. He was very hungry around that. And in those early years, we were in a bunker. We were in this room after every session discussing performance, high performance, team, group, culture, you name it. And we were almost tic-tacking on the basis of lessons and insights.
And on that point of, because it's a really interesting point you make around what I refer to as the standards that are being set by Jim, you know, but as a leader. And it used to blow me away with, and this is where I'd be interested to know, like, what the dynamic was there when you were in them huddles, is because I do recall a game we played against Wicklow, and I think we won by, you know, maybe 15 points, and it was an excellent performance from, and I remember going to the train on the Tuesday after the game thinking, how are we going to analyse, how is Jim going to, you know, analyse this in his little prelude to training? And he showed a video clip, which was of five clips in the game, and it was clips of five hand passes that went to the ground or to behind the person who was supposed to be receiving it. And he showed the clips and he said, "Is that our standard?" And everyone obviously said no. And he goes, "Get out and train." And that was it, right? And it was as powerful a session as we've done, because it was his ability to get down into the detail and to really figure out some small things that would really drive standards and behaviours. And we talk about, you know, value, having values, yes, but your values then drive your standards, and that's then, you know, what helps cultivate your culture really effectively. And he was so good at that, getting down into the detail. So on one hand, you have got a guy who's big picture, want to become the greatest performing Gaelic football team. And on the other hand, then you've got him down in the detail to make sure the standards are, you know, of the highest calibre right across the board. So were you impressed with his ability to be up there at the 30,000 feet level and then really just get down into the weeds of things to make sure that we maintain those standards right across the board? And that's only one example. He did that across all the different facets and pillars of performance. Were you impressed with his ability to be able to do that?
I was probably more impressed with his capacity to be able to consistently do that, so to stay on top of it. So that speaks to the leader's values. It's really important. If it's your values, it's something I see in you every day. So if you want to know what my values are, look at what I do every day. Mm. So you could pretty much work out Jim's values by observing him, right? Because he behaved in a particular way. He set himself up to be the most effective he could be by ensuring that he dedicated the right time to getting to those 5 points in that game, for example. So it wasn't that he threw lots of detail at you, it was that he threw the detail that was most important at that moment in time. And that doesn't come by accident, it comes by a lot of detail, focus around what he needs to bring to the table. So a clear recognition, I would think, within him around what his responsibility was and what his performance was for the team. So he's not just a leader of the team, he's a member of the team. So how do I contribute to that group to ensure that they are most effective, whether that's my coaching group, my backroom team, or whether it's the player group? So I think that was critical, and a critical principle for him was that preparation is 9/10 of performance. Mm-hmm. And if he was asking his team to value that, well, then he had to value it also. So a lot of the work that Jim had done to get to those key moments and key insights, nobody saw it.
Yeah.
Like, he went deep on that to get those key insights out of it. So I think that was really, really powerful. Plus, I think it was the role of the leader was to keep our feet on the ground. While we had these ambitions to get to summits, etc., it was about being humble. It was about remaining curious. It was about never being complacent, right? Never getting ahead of yourself. And so anytime you got a bit of a lift in your ego, he was very quick to cut you and bring you back down to the floor, so that you remained connected with what it is you needed to do and what it was you needed to contribute.
And that requires trust across the board, like from a management level between one another in that circle of trust at management level, but also from a player's perspective too, that like he did, he had a great ability of cutting players and calling people out, and then we all called one another out, you know, when standards began to dip. And it was because he had such... You knew he was watching, you know, you knew he didn't miss things. And then we just decided, well, we took the accountability on ourselves to drive them standards, because we knew that he valued them. And the consistency piece there is probably, you're right, is the most impressive. It is easy to come in one week and say, okay, I'm going to focus on one thing, you know, but to be able to do it over the course of, you know, as long as I worked under Jim, like, so, you know, for me, it was 5 years, maybe 6 years actually, but for you as well, it's probably around that term too. That's insanely impressive, and I just that was one of the things that really absolutely impressed me about Jim. And the other thing that impressed me about him too was the communication. So if you think about it, like, organizations always have these visions, or, you know, teams have these visions and they have these values, but like, to be able to take that then and to adopt it into, okay, what's my role within this? What's my role, Paul Flynn, as a half forward? What's my role within this collective group that leads up to division, right? So how does my role relate to division of the team? So we're trying to be the greatest performing team. I have a role to do for the team on a particular day. That to me requires obviously consistency in the messaging, consistency in the consistently communicating to players, to individuals in different ways. When you look at Jim versus, and I spend a lot of time on Jim here, but versus other managers that you've worked with, versus other leaders that you've been able to, his communication style, his communication overall, you know, what was the one part of that really impressed you?
It was always on message. It was always on purpose. So this kind of drawing down what's really purposeful in what I need to get across to the group right now. And I think what he discovered and what I observed was that essentially the inter-county environment of whether it be football or hurling is essentially a high performance, you're trying to cultivate a high performance culture in an amateur time frame, which meant that your communication, your planning, your logistics, your detail just had to be right. You didn't get lots of time with players. You got very short windows in which you had to impact significantly upon them. So his organization was just incredible. I mean, he had the T's crossed and the I's dotted. He put people around him, right, that assisted him in doing what he needed to do really, really well. Mm. So where he needed to close a gap on maybe an area that he couldn't cover, he always made sure he had the right person around him to do that really, really well. He had a very strong team around him, and he valued that, and he empowered his team to cover their end and cover it exceptionally well. He had a very clear expectation on what he expected from each of the members of his wider management team, to ensure that environment worked exceptionally well. So things felt seamless within that environment, but there was a lot of work and detail underneath that to make that happen. So I think that he recognised, I don't have a lot of time here. I can fluff around and have meetings for hours and have, you know, and not get enough time on the pitch. He valued what was most important. When he had team meetings, they were always short. If he needed to do something longer, he did it outside of the training week, etc. So he was, in my mind, he was very well organised, and he knew that he had to cut out the right insight from the detail because he didn't have a lot of time to be going through all that detail that he would have had. So,
and how does that differ then from your role with a professional outfit now, like with Irish Rugby or even with Leinster Rugby that you would have worked with in the past? Or even with cricket, like how the difference between working with amateur athletes and working with professionals, the fundamentals I'm sure remain the same, but the approach is obviously different.
Yeah, look, if you take the professional game of rugby at international level, they have a very tight window also, so they only get access to their players and to their wider group. They only get access to them 7-8 weeks in a campaign. And if there's 3-4 campaigns in a year, well, then that gives you an idea of how much development time they have, how much time they have to develop the team, how much time they have to grow performance. And then you have these gaps in between campaigns where, you know, how do you ensure that you're still cultivating a culture when the team is not with you anymore? So they have a huge challenge in how they do that, at least in the context of Gaelic football. You've seen the players almost every week. Mm. It's become a longer season, as you know, that the season is almost never ending. So you get a lot more regular access to your players to continue to cultivate that. There's a much different challenge within the professional game of rugby. But that's coaches can't just be coaches anymore. They have to be architects of their system. They have to be architects of their environments. They have to understand how they can leverage the environment to impact better behaviour from players, how they can impact on the environment to empower players to take responsibility for their own behaviour and their own growth, so that when they go away, they're continuing to focus on the things that we believe to be important to them realising their potential. Now, Jim was very powerful at that, so he didn't hold the baton. He delegated it. So he delegated it to the players. You asked about trust, you asked about communication. It grew as a result of his trust his confidence in the players, the way in which he communicated, again, taking your cue from the leader. Players trusted themselves and then trusted each other to challenge, but also to support, because he handed the baton down. He expected you guys to take responsibility for that, to step up and be leaders, to step up and take responsibility for the group, to step up and make sure that you're accountable for yourself, right, and your own contribution and commitment. So I think he cultivated that. And a lot of leaders, whether they be in business or in sport, struggle with the delegation exercise. They try and control too much, right? And they don't have the trust in themselves, potentially sometimes, to let go, or in those around them to let go. And I think that delegation of trust, that delegation of empowerment with a structure. And that was something I think that he was very clear on. There's a structure, there's a set of conditions around handing this over, and there's an expectation, and it's clear. But once that's done, well, then people can operate in a safe environment, right, in order to grow both individually and collectively.
Yeah, I think that's it's one of the most impressive things that I've kind of seen from your involvement with Jim, because I kind of grouped them both together. And it really did help build, I guess, accountability and trust. But one of the other things that really helped to build trust was, I suppose, Jim's kind of holy trinity, and which I'm sure you would have kind of been very aware of and involved in, is the idea that it's a holistic development of a player is now critically important, and probably more, well, maybe not, but you could argue that it's more important in Gaelic games because of the fact that they are amateur athletes, where you're not just developing an athlete to play a game. These guys are also professionals. They also have personal lives. So you've got that physical, professional and personal kind of trinity of their life. And Jim was excellent at empowering or creating the environment, as you would have said just there, to allow players to develop in all parts of their life. So he was excellent at involving the families in the squad and creating that link then with the partners and the families with the team. He was also excellent at making sure that players were afforded the time to be professionals, to be students, to do whatever they needed to do, you know, as part of their careers. And I have many examples of how he helped me in that space, to not just maybe whether it be giving you a week off here, or just, you know, creating space for you to be able to focus on what's most important for you right now. In the knowledge that he was building trust, he was layering on the trust each time, that in the pillar that he was probably most, you know, interested in, the physical element of it, you were going to perform for him because he had, you know, brought all these other parts of your life together. So I think that was one of the most impressive things that Jim did. And then what he was able to do in within that physical bracket, break it into the four pillars of, okay, we had to be technically strong, one. We had to be tactically really aware, two. We had to be physically conditioned to be able to perform. And the final one, which we spent a lot of time on, which you certainly would have led the charge on, was the psychological element, was the mindset, the mindfulness, that pillar that he'd often refer to as the one we don't know as much about, the one we don't know how many marginal gains there are to help us to improve our performance, our overall performance. And we spent a lot of time doing yoga. We spent a lot of time increasing our capacity in that space, so that when, you know, we were able to improve our overall performance. What was your thoughts on that approach? Firstly, of the overall, the Holy Trinity, and how he then broke down them four pillars, and then maybe your role in the mindfulness pillar, if you like. That's a long question.
Let's look at the Holy Trinity piece, because it's really, really interesting, because it sits again as, you know, if you look at that kind of military background, you look at the values that military training had given him. You know, it was always about the people first, right? His service, his responsibility. Beyond that, it was about the county. Beyond that, it was about years. So he had a very very clear sense of his purpose and his role around the team. And I think he was genuinely committed. He wasn't looking to leverage something to get something else. He was genuinely committed to, and he recognized the contribution that family makes to the player and how the player turns up. Right, so the respect and the valuing of family was really important to him. He also recognised that you guys had a life, a career, an education outside of being professional, essentially in how you turned up to develop as players. He also recognised that support was required in that area. There are other things going on, and if those things are not aligned and in a good place, it's going to affect upon your ability to be committed fully, to have your mind focused when you come into training, etc. So it made sense that you would do that, but not, you have to internally value that to make it work. And also, I think he had a view that he wasn't just developing players, he was developing men, right? Because obviously this is a male team, he was developing men. He wanted them to carry stuff beyond their playing career that would benefit other parts of their lives, whether they became dads or whether they became leaders in business, whatever, that they would take those principles and those values into other aspects of their lives and it would enhance them. And that's why I think he was always trying, I think, to give you a world perspective. You know, that what we do is what we love doing. You know, it's what everyone was really passionate about. But there's a, you know, there are bigger things. You know, losing a game is not the end of the world, right? We need to find perspective. And I think he was able to always help us to find perspective and see that there was a bigger world, there was bigger things, whether it was charity, whether it was children's hospitals, whether it was going out and seeing the history of the nation or whatever. That was critical to that. He was educating and developing the team as much as people as he was as players. So that was critical.
And just to stop you there on that before you go into the next part, which is you're lecturing in London Business School on everything high performance and leadership. Is that what you're seeing across the when you're doing these lectures and the feedback you're having from classes? Is that holistic development, is that happening in businesses now as well as just in sports?
I think we have no choice but to go there in sport. And business, from my observation of the space, we don't go that far. Like, so some businesses are trying to get a little bit closer to the person and to the life that surrounds that person, because you can't separate the person from the professional. You just, you know, it's difficult to separate the personal life from the professional life. And a work we've always, I think, in the past tried to separate them. I think we're recognising now that we need to be more holistic in our approach, that ultimately it's about helping someone to be fully committed and helping them to be more consistent in the contribution they make to the organisation or the business. And if we don't go in there, we've got to do that in sport. We are much deeper. We have to be much deeper if we're going to. If it's human performance, we have to understand what drives it, what supports it, what underpins it. If we don't, well, then we can't get consistency in how people show up and how they deliver their performance, both individually and collectively. So I'm not sure. I think business is on a journey towards that, but I'm not sure they're quite there yet. Can they eyeball a member of their team really and give recognition not just for what they're doing in terms of their day-to-day work, but beyond that, what else is going on in their life that's impacting upon that and how they may be able to support them to allow them to turn up better and more consistently in the context of the role they have for the organisation. So I think that's a big piece, and there is a difference, I see, at least in the two worlds. However, I've also met leaders who are all over that space, who really want to get in behind that, get a little bit deeper around their own senior teams. That's the space we work in. We work at that kind of senior leadership level. The leader himself or herself trying to understand their performance, their role, their sense of purpose around their senior team, and how to provide that support and environment to get the very, very best of the group that's around them, because essentially that's the conduit through which they deliver organizational performance. From that group down into their next group, that's the conduit through which they deliver. So no leader drives organization performance. We lead through people. We lead through the performance of others. So if we're not in there and we're not understanding what that takes, if we're not setting up our structures to essentially facilitate people to be more effective and in how they work together and the way in which they work together, that we understand across, like if you look at sport, we have offense and defense essentially. But these two parts of our structure have to be fully integrated. They have to be looking to deliver a very similar game plan. And yet we have business that's a little bit more complex, I suspect, with lots of different substructures that sit within it that in some way are supporting each other but may find it difficult, right, to come together as a unified team. So more challenging in business, but not undoable.
And that's a lot of the work that you're doing with Uppercut now, and the high performance advisory business is working with leaders in business to try and tap that performance element that you've brought to sport, and like, because it is human performance, it is getting the best out of human beings, whether it's sport or whether it's in any walk of life. There's definitely, you know, lessons that can be learned and adopted.
Yeah, 100%. And so if we look at, say, the mindset pillar within that setup, and there's a reason why it was put in there as that mindset piece, because I was looking at, when I went into that discussion with Jim earlier on, that a lot of what needs to be in place is in place. So the environment supports most of our mental development, right? Our mental capability. So there was a lot supporting your ability essentially to mentally execute, both in the context of how you prepared, but also in the context of how you performed. There was a lot of things right around the standards, around the support that was there for you guys. So there was a couple of aspects that we needed to go into with regard to that ability to be more present, the ability to be intentional on what you did, the ability to apply your focus to the right things consistently, as opposed to shifting between one thing or another, trying to find an answer. And that ability to see the three dimensions of time, of which only one exists, and that is the past, the present, and the future, with only the present being the only time that exists. And how to look at the past with regard to your value in it, to take lessons, to essentially evaluate your experience, to take what's valuable from that to progress you forward, to only look at the future to set your intention. But not to ruminate in the past about what has gone and what you have achieved or not, and not to be concerned about the future and what might happen, but to be focused on what you're doing right now. And we got into that concept, we got right behind it, and that group was quite an intelligent group. They got under the bonnet of it, understood it, and start to apply it to their own practice, which became very, very significant for a number of reasons.
And like, I remember, this is Viktor Frankl and the stimulus and response, and the gap in between that we tried to build our mental capacity, our mindfulness training to allow that space in between the stimulus and response to make good decisions and to stay in the present, like you just said. And I think there's a couple of things that strike me about that. Is one, like, a lot of people outside would have heard, people outside the Dublin setup would have heard us speak about, or Jim in particular, speaking about the process, sticking to the process. And that's what this is, right? That's what it is. It's about staying in the present. You're not dwelling on the past, whether it was a good player or it was a bad player, whether it was a good game or a bad game. You're not dwelling on it. You're learning from it, yes, but you're staying and focused on what you can control, which is in the present. And you're certainly not thinking about the future, which is probably what we did in 2015 when we're 6 points up and probably have half of an eye on the final, and we're thinking about the future and we're not sticking to the game plan. We're not sticking to the process. That was one of the cornerstones of what made us a great team. And, you know, I only watched Patrick Cantley a couple of weeks ago winning the FedEx Cup, and in his post game interview he mentions this exact same kind of way of thinking. All he spoke about was the process. All he was thinking about was getting a good contact on the ball, walking up to the next ball, addressing the ball, following his process that he has before every shot, and then getting a good strike. And I think that's so important in sport. And you just touched on it there, and I just think it's also really important in any walk of life, because it brings in, you know, really good decision making, you know, less irrational behaviour. You're really clear in what you're trying to do when you're playing, and you're in the present. And it, as I say, it was one of the cornerstones of what we as a group did, and your influence on that was huge. So just talk me through that a little bit, because I think you can talk about this all day, but your view on how we were good at doing that and how we got to that point, I suppose.
Well, you know, all business, either sport or business, no matter what sector you're in, there's a results nature to it. Like, it's, you'd often hear people say we're a results driven business. You know, I'd say, yeah, okay, but you don't control the result because it's in the past. Results is always behind you, it's never in front of you. Targets and outcomes you want to achieve and intention is in front of you, but you've got to learn to let it go. That once you've established a goal, either at an individual or at a collective level, and we all look at it and say that's what we're committed to, you then draw the line to the attention, right? Where our focus needs to be to get there, right? And performance is a process, right? It's a process. And as long as we follow that process, and within that process, we know what the critical factors are, right? Which are, for me, key behaviors. We go after those critical factors. These are the factors that help us to win the game, no matter whether you're in Gaelic football, whether you're in hurling, rugby, or whether you're in business. There are factors that if you focus on them and you do them better than your opposition, there's a good chance, right, that you'll come out with the outcome you want. But again, you must focus on the process, and within the process, you must focus on the right factors within that. And I think, again, when you can give that information to a lot of different groups, and only certain groups will take it on and assimilate it into everything that they do. And this group assimilated it into everything they did. That sense of concentration, endurance, to build through the process. There's times when you'll drift, and there's times when you'll come back to process, but the process is what kept you in the game. The process is what gave you access to your ability. It gave you access to all the preparation you've done. And in those moments, you could release that. It's not to say that the game doesn't shift. It's not to say that chaos doesn't come in and affect individuals or affect the group, but always trying to get back onto that process space and back onto what we are expecting of ourselves in the context of performance.
And as an individual within that, that's what you're trying to achieve. Like, anytime I had my best performances, I was in the zone, if you want to use that term. You're only focused on the present. So that's what in the zone really is. Am I right?
Yeah, but you're not even aware you're focused on the present. You're just in it. Right? You're immersed. That's what you are. You're immersed. There's no part of you outside of that immersion. You're fully immersed. And all of the things that you've done, all the patterns that you've ran through just become natural. You see things quicker. Time expands a little bit. You feel you have a little bit more space. That type of stuff. It's that full focus leads to flow. Flow can be disrupted, but also can be re-entered. And it's the confidence to know that if you drift, you're out of the game, right? If you go back to being present and focus on the next thing, you can go back into that space. So, yeah, I think, like, it's the holy grail for a lot of players, you know, but you can still high perform without flow state. Right, you can still perform exceptionally without that flow state, but there will be moments in your career where you completely get immersed, where everything just feels a lot easier in the context of the execution of your performance. But yeah, it's that's the space that everybody wants to get to.
It is. And we're coming to the end now, but I kind of, like, we've touched on, I suppose, a lot of what we've done with Dublin. We've touched on there'll be some of the stuff you're doing outside of sport. What are the common traits that you see amongst the really good leaders, you know? And what is it that even you're seeing within the London Business School? Like, what is it that is high performance? If you could kind of capture in maybe two or three points, what's the common traits, I suppose?
Traits is probably, whether it's befitting of that, an answer to that question, I'm not sure, because I'm going to start with purpose, because I think those leaders who have a very clear sense of purpose are the leaders that you want to engage with, that are people that you want to be around. You want to get into a conversation with them because that sense of purpose, that clarity that they have, you know, not just for themselves, but for the organization, for the team, that they communicate that in a way that's very, very different. They share it in a way that's very, very different. they seem to be able to translate that down into all their interactions and why they make decisions the way they do, why they generate questions. So I think purpose is for me that common, if you want to call it a trait, it's the common, is elixir the right word? It is this special stuff that when a leader is grounded in purpose, when a leadership team is grounded in their purpose, when any team below that is grounded in purpose, an organization is always better for it. So that's a big piece for me, because you can have the other traits and the other aspects, but in the absence of intention, in the absence of what we want to achieve, what we want to become, what I expect of myself, what I expect of others, in the absence of a clarity around that, the other stuff will fall below its potential. That's in my mind for sure. Outside of that, it is, you know, a lot of the traits that we spoke about in gym, and everybody is different and people will find different ways to the mountain. There's all different types of paths that you can go. There's no core set of traits that every leader should have. It's about finding what's right for you. It's about finding that what you can really dedicate yourself to, a sense of this feels right for me. It feels part of who I am. It's starting to recognize what your own character is, right? And that the aspects of that character that are really supportive of your own potential, that you expose them in the context of your leadership. Going beyond that, I think it's that recognition of your responsibility as a leader. And I don't know how many times leaders are reflecting on their responsibility. How much is that related to the performance of the business, and how much of that is related to the performance of the people? You know, so how do you separate those two things? You know, the outcomes and the results, to how my responsibility is being met with regard to setting the right environment for people to be successful. How do I do that as a leader? What am I actually doing today to ensure that anything that prevents or blocks us from being effective as a team or an organization, that it's my responsibility and it's the leadership community's responsibility within our organization to address that? Not next week, not next year, not next month, but today, tomorrow, the next day, and the next day. So you're down in that space and you see yourself as, I guess, a farmer of that environment to ensure that you cultivate it in a way that gives people the best chance of being successful.
And last question then, if for anybody listening, any individuals who maybe aren't leading teams or they're not involved in sport, leading yourself is where it all starts. And, you know, I know one of the things that we would have worked on when we worked on a one-to-one basis was around energy management, was around, you know, for me, it was compartmentalizing the different parts of my life that I won, but also bringing blue energy or versus red energy. Blue energy bringing the positive energy to everything that I did, and red energy bringing the negative energy. And how important that was for me to just to start off each week or each day leading myself first and foremost before you could even start to think about, you know, the collective or other parts of it. So for any individual listening, what kind of message do you have that this is not about just, you know, leading teams or cultivating a culture? It starts with the individual. So what message do you have there for anybody who's, you know, times have been tough over the last 18 months and hopefully we're coming out of it, but, you know, I don't think you can ever take your eye off this, the idea of, you know, taking ownership of yourself, of your own emotions, your own energy. What to leave everybody with a nice message, just to kind of take it into their week or into their day, what would it be?
Well, we're all thinking, feeling beings. We can't cut that off. It's always going to be there. We're constantly thinking, and if we think about something long enough, it'll become an emotion. You know, it'll drift from the brain into the body, and we'll feel it. We use a term of our two opposite poles of positive and negative, and sometimes that's not the right terms to be using. And there's always, I think, some underpinning rationale for some of the aspects of what we feel. You described them as energies. It's an emotional energy or a thought process that's creating an energy that's either positive or it's negative. And we would have talked about that self-awareness, that recognizing what energy supports what it is you want to achieve, whether it's in your relationship, whether it's in your performance or your role or whatever else that sits there. And becoming aware that if you're in a negative state, that you're cultivating that, that you have a responsibility to address that. And just that recognition that that's where you are, that you're in that, what we would have described as that red state. And if you're in there, you're feeding it, you're choosing it. And it's not that you can move straight from that into a positive state, but you can move from a negative state into a clear state, that you're putting yourself into a position to be more logical, in a position to think more clearly. Okay, I don't feel great about this. I feel a bit disappointed about this, but what do I need to do next? What do I need to take responsibility for? So to think a little bit clearly sometimes when you're feeling down or you're feeling negative, helps you to begin at least a step forward with behaviors that are going to help you to get some progression on where you're at. From a positive state, I think it's often we don't think that we have to cultivate a positive state. So what are you doing to cultivate that? What thoughts are you actually feeding? We describe it as the gardener. You know, if you're planting weeds, all you're going to get back is weeds. Whereas if you're planting flowers and color, and so what are you doing? What are you grateful for? What are you focused on today to make an impact on? What does that look like? Are you feeding that into yourself, or are you dealing with all the time regurgitating the challenges that you're faced with in the context of your role, or a colleague that you're not getting on with, or a manager who is not helping you or is being difficult? Are you cultivating that by continuing to regurgitate it within your system, or are you saying, this is not healthy for me, this is not good for me, I'm gonna put my hand up here and stop, and I'm gonna start to think about what's best for me, what can I control? What behavior do I need to step into to take responsibility for where I'm at right now, and to find your way into that? So it's almost managing your energy systems, being aware of which ones are conducive with your happiness and what you want to achieve, and which ones are just pulling you back and preventing you from moving forward. And are you taking personal ownership and responsibility for being more aware of how your own system works and speaks to you? And to, I guess, take a little bit more control over your self-talk, that inner dialogue that you have, to ensure that you can begin to cultivate a more positive or optimistic view of what's in front of you.
Brilliant. I think that's a lovely message to leave things on. Gary Keegan, thanks very much for joining me today. It was thoroughly enjoyable. I could have went on for probably another hour, but I think that's a lovely way to end it. So, Gary Keegan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.